Oyez, oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order that they will be presented, they are 050754, Margarita Morales versus the Liberty Mutual Insurance Company and the Continental Casualty Company from El Paso County and the 8th District. 050791, Fortis Benefits against Vanessa Cantu and the Ford Motor Company from Johnson County and the 10th District. And 050823, PHC Menden versus Kimberly Clark Corporation from Gregg County and the 12th District. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side in each of those three matters. The court will take a brief recess in between the arguments in these cases and anticipates that the arguments will be concluded before lunch. Tape recording is being made of the arguments this morning and will be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The Chief Justice cannot be in attendance this morning, but will participate in all of these cases. The court is ready to hear argument in 050754, Morales against Liberty Mutual.
May it please the court, Mr. Toblaski will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. Placek will present arguments for the amicus. The petitioner will open with the first 11 minutes and has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The Workers' Compensation Act has a two-track system for judicial review under 410.301 and 255. Any decision that affects whether a claimant receives income benefits or death benefits is one regarding compensability or eligibility and is governed by 301. This includes decisions regarding whether or not a worker is an employee or an independent contractor. Section 255, on the other hand, only covers a narrow range of collateral issues that do not affect whether a claimant receives benefits.
What are those things? What things do you have to try in Travis County?
It's a very narrow range. As this court explained in functional restoration, attorney's fees issues, and certain issues regarding differences of opinion on spinal surgery. This court recognized in functional restoration that 255 does not affect anything regarding income benefits or death benefits, but only covers that narrow range of collateral issues. It's possible the legislature, and likely the legislature, intended for medical benefits to fall under 255 as well. But this court concluded as drafted, the statute did not reach medical benefits at all, and that the only thing left, but 301 is where the real work happens. 301 is where everything regarding the award or amount of death benefits or income benefits occurs. The Court of Appeals' erroneous distinction between questions of coverage and compensability should be reversed for three reasons. First, it has no basis in the text of the Workers' Compensation Act. Second, it conflicts with this court's decisions in Rodriguez and Garcia. And third, it creates an unworkable test that will lead to confusion and creates absurd consequences the legislature never intended. The word coverage never appears in Section 255, 301, or anywhere else in Chapter 410 of the Labor Code, which governs judicial review. This is because the word compensability includes coverage. Coverage is an element of compensability, and this is seen in the plain text of the statute. The statute defines compensable injury as any injury that arises out of the course and scope of employment. And employment necessarily requires that a worker be an employee of a subscriber. And you can see this by looking at kind of the way the definitions incorporate each other at 401.011. The compensable injury says anything that occurs in the scope of employment. Course and scope of employment is defined as an activity performed by an employee while engaged in or about the furtherance of the affairs of an employer. Employer itself is statutorily defined as a person who makes contracts or hire, employs employees, and has coverage. Coverage is not a separate inquiry at all. It is part and parcel of the compensability inquiry. The Court of Appeals distinction here only brings confusion and a lack of clarity to what is a simple test, and it's a test that this court set forth in Rodriguez. Does the decision affect benefits? If the answer is yes, it falls under 301. And let me be specific, only income or death benefits. If it affects income or death benefits, it's 301 analysis. On page 254 in Rodriguez, the court specifically noted that when it concluded, because impairment ratings affect benefits, it's 301. The test is no more complicated than that. Secondly, disputes regarding employment status, that is a worker, an employee, or an independent contractor, is not an issue. To the extent coverage is separate at all, employment status does not fall in that category. Employment status is an element of the course and scope of employment. This court in Garcia specifically noted that whether a worker is in the course and scope of their employment when they're injured falls under 301. And course and scope of employment is specifically defined as an activity performed by an employee. So whether or not someone is an employee is part of course and scope of employment, which falls under 301. That is consistent with how workers' compensation analysis has worked in this state going back to the original act in 1913. Prior to the 1989 act being passed, and this court in Bryant defined and it said an injury is compensable if, and the first thing it said, he is an employee. When the statute in 89 was passed, the definition of course and scope of employment mirrors the definition in Bryant. Whether or not you're an employee falls within that definition.
What would a coverage dispute look like that was filed here in Austin? Would it just be between the employer and the comp carrier as to whether the employer was in fact insured, regardless of whether the person injured was their employee or not?
Your Honor, the first point is that we don't ask whether something is coverage at all. As the Austin Court noted in Texas Property, it's not a useful distinction. Compensability and coverage often overlap. There's no question regarding whether or not something is a coverage issue. The sole test under 301 is, does it regard compensability or eligibility? The Houston General case presents a very different situation. In that case, you had a situation where it was undisputed that the worker was an employee of a single employer.
But for example, carrier was saying that the employer hadn't paid premiums and the policy had lapsed, would that be a coverage question to bring in Travis County? Whether the employer had a policy?
Yeah. Whether the employer had a policy, the inquiry is whether or not it's a question of compensability. Coverage is part and parcel of that analysis. Now, to the extent it doesn't affect whether a claimant receives benefits, if it affects whether a claimant receives benefits.
No, but what I'm talking about is just that question. Let's say that the carrier files a deck action and says there's no coverage here. Where would that be filed?
That would be filed under 301, Your Honor, because to the extent a carrier says, I don't have coverage, if that leaves an employee with effectively working for a non-subscriber, that decision affects compensability. It affects whether the employee receives benefits.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand what does constitute just coverage, just a sole coverage question that would be appropriate here.
The facts that in the Houston General case may fall in what you're referring to as a coverage question. In that case, the benefits, the employee's benefits were never at issue. It was a fight between two carriers as to who owed benefits for an injury occurred on August 1st when the employer was rolling over between policies. But the important inquiry and what is important for the jurisprudence of the state to explain and show is that we don't even need to ask the coverage question. It simply, is it compensability or not compensability? Asking this additional question of coverage, as the Third Court of Appeals noted in Texas Property, only leads to confusion because these are heavily overlapping issues.
Why is this question of jurisdiction rather than venue?
It's a fair point, Your Honor, and I honestly am not quite sure. These have always been treated.
It seems to me we're getting the whole reason the legislature changed the venue statute was that we don't do exactly what we do here. Every case gets appealed to the Texas Supreme Court to find out if we filed it in the right place before we ever have the trial or anything else. We're just back to pleas of privilege if this is jurisdictional. Nothing in the statute says it's jurisdictional. Have we ever said it's jurisdictional? Or is this, are y'all just up here on a venue matter?
I believe in Rodriguez, the court may have referred, and did in fact refer to this as a jurisdictional inquiry, but at this point it effectively is jurisdictional because it's too late for us to go back and refile in Travis County. But the important issue is that the rule doesn't need to be that complicated. The test laid out in Rodriguez for eligibility or compensability removes all this uncertainty. If the effect of the decision of the appeals panel affects whether a claimant is getting benefits or not getting benefits, you're under 301. It's a simple, clear rule that provides certainty and avoids this collateral litigation over which county you file in. And we don't even need to worry about too much whether it's a venue issue or a jurisdictional issue. It's just a simple test. The appeals panel's decision, which is being refuted, affects compensability. Furthermore, the test adopted by the court below in this case and respondents push for.
I mean, before we go too far from that, I'm not sure I understand why you say it's jurisdictional now. If it's just a venue matter and the trial court's just wrong in exercising venue, our legislature wants us to say, tough, go ahead through the whole trial, waste your time on the appeal, and we'll reverse it automatically and then transfer it to Travis County. So why is that? Is this not a venue question?
Because the difference between venue is one aspect of the difference between 301 and 255, but there are a number of other issues in play. In particular, the standard of review. If a court holds that an issue is governed by 255,
of course, there again, people apply the wrong standard of review, and it doesn't deprive the trial court of jurisdiction normally.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. However, when you move something over to 255, you're not just changing the venue. You're changing the fundamental procedure of how it's tried. It's no longer going to be a modified de novo jury trial. You're going to have substantial evidence review under the Administrative Procedures Act. This is much more than just what county you file in, although that is one of the important issues that this issue affects. I would briefly like to turn to what respondents refer to as their alternative issues and basis of affirmance. Every issue the appeals panel decided adversely to Morales's was challenged in the first amended petition on file in the trial court.
The timeliness and the compensability were challenged.
Absolutely. The compensability issue was directly challenged. It specifically said that the appeals panel erred and said what they thought the right analysis was. And you can see that at page 28 in the record. It also, at page 25 in the record, incorporated by reference the entire decision of the appeals panel. And on page 29 of the record, which is the first amended petition, they ask that the judgment of the appeals panel be reversed. And this is a case not cited in the briefs, but I think it's particularly instructive, is the first court's decision in Houston Community College Systems versus Schneider, 67 Southwest 3rd, 241, which dealt with almost a precisely identical issue. And the court there held that this is just a fleeting issue. You're not going to get bounced on it. It's consistent with this court's statement in Albertsons versus Sinclair that the procedural requirements of the Labor Code are not jurisdictional. And it also makes clear that this inquiry in particular is not constitutional. We'll let Mr. Plexig get up now. Thank you.
May I please accord Scott Plasek for Texas Mutual Insurance Company. I'd like to first respond to the question about why this is jurisdictional and how it arises in the context of jurisdiction. An appeal under 410.301 has a statutory filing deadline of 40 days. An appeal under 410.255 is under the APA judicial review provision, which has a 30-day filing period. So the way this generally arises is somebody files a compensability challenge in the county of the worker's residence between 30 and 40 days after the decision. The opponent then moves to dismiss it for plea to jurisdiction, saying this is substantial evidence, you didn't file within 30 days, the court doesn't have jurisdiction. Because I think
a lot of CAs think in the whistleblower and other contexts that that's not jurisdictional, that's just limitations. Like limitations, you need to raise it by summary judgment.
Well, it's
I mean, if you're late, you're late.
The court in Morales certainly...
People file stuff late in courts all the time. Courts don't throw up their hands and say, we're out of jurisdiction, we have no power. I mean, they just say, you're late, you're out.
In the context, though, of administrative law and review of agency decisions, I think it's been, and I was a little bit surprised by the question, so I don't have the citation for you, but I think numerous cases say that if you don't file within the deadline, the court has no jurisdiction over the case. The power of a court to review an agency decision arises because you follow the APA, and that it contains a 30-day deadline. And if you don't follow it, then there's no jurisdiction there.
Of course, pushed to its logical conclusion, we could do the same with limitations. We could, as I asked counsel yesterday, turn everything in the rule book into a plea to the jurisdiction, because that way you can appeal them all the way up, and there are no rules, and you can do evidence or maybe not do evidence and all this other stuff. Do we really want to do that?
No, but I think the difference comes because you are in the administrative process, and you are in a right to be in court that creates only because that exists only because the statute created it, with very specific instructions as to how you get there to begin with. I would like to address, though, why Texas Mutual is here as an amicus. They have a great concern over the breadth of the Morales decision. The Labor Code does not, at no point, enumerates what issues are to be considered for appeal under the substantial evidence rule. It just refers to compensability and other than compensability. Now, as Mr. Kowalski mentioned, the court in Garcia and Continental Casualties noted that substantial evidence is a very narrow category. And that's a good thing, because the lack of specific enumeration in the code leads many carriers and sometimes claimants to double file their lawsuits in Travis County and in the county of the workers' residence to make sure that they don't waive some right of appeal, because these things are being tossed down on jurisdictional grounds, just like we've seen in this case. That difficulty is now significantly greater under Morales. Under Morales, all questions of employment status, to be sure, along with any other issue that could be possibly called a coverage issue, falls into this gray area. And you're going to see cases filed in Travis and in the workers' home county to make sure that you don't lose your rights. And the scope of a coverage compensability distinction, which is found nowhere in the statute, is frighteningly large. In this case, independent contractor versus employee. Does a policy exist? Was a policy canceled? Are there two potentially covered employers? Which one? Is there an additional named insured? What was the date of injury? Which has always been a compensability issue. Now, is it a coverage issue? Because that date of injury affects whether it's inside or outside of the policy. Each of those issues could be called coverage issues. But as the Austin Court of Appeals noted in Texas Property, the controlling inquiry is whether the dispute is one of compensability or eligibility for benefits, not whether the claim can alternatively or additionally be called a coverage claim or a coverage dispute. That's the crux of the problem with Morales and with the false dichotomy that the respondent urges by calling for this coverage versus compensability distinction.
Wasn't there a legislative intent, though, to move these issues outside the courts as much as possible?
It was to restrict the number of issues.
You can answer.
Certainly. Not as to the core compensation issues, as I think the court made clear in Garcia. The core issues of compensation, compensability, who do you work for? Is your worker part of the system? What were you in the course and scope of your employment? Those things remain and preserve a jury trial right for the claimant, for the carrier, for anyone involved. And you can't determine either of those, compensable injury or course of and scope of employment, without walking through the statute and figuring out at some point, was there coverage?
Any other questions?
one other question. What did what do you think Garcia meant when it said that it's not compensability when we have a dispute over medical benefits?
The question of compensability is, were you injured in the course and scope of your employment? The statute sets up a very specific method for determining what medical benefits are appropriate. Was this care reasonable and necessary? Did the doctor charge the right fees under the statute? Those sort of things. Those are rights that are created under the statute. For instance, you know, what's the fee that a doctor gets for a particular service? Those are things that are set by the old Compensation Commission, now the Division of Workers' Compensation. Those sort of rights only arise from the statute. They have no common law predecessor derivation. Those rights remain. They're initially, before as Continental Casualty recognized it, there wasn't a review system for them. The legislature's now gone back and created one, and it specifically put those medical benefits under substantial evidence review. And that was done in the statute.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court's ready to hear argument. You can respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Brennan will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. David Boyce and I represent the respondents. If you read the briefs of petitioners and amicus curiae, the court is left with the impression that this case presents the pinnacle issue of whether an independent contractor or employee creates a coverage question. We don't believe that the El Paso Court of Appeals held any such thing, nor do we believe that you can arrive at that conclusion unless the record in this case is totally disregarded. Fortunately, we do have the benefit of the record in this case, and we don't believe that the court can even address that issue with the facts of this case. The court held in this case, first, that a coverage question is a question that is not a question of compensability. And they further held, pursuant to this court's decision in Rodriguez v. Service Lloyds, that questions of non-compensability are subject to judicial review under 410.255. They then held that because 410.255 is a jurisdictional provision, 410.255 mandates that jurisdiction is in Travis County for this dispute. Now,
what's going to happen in that suit? What issues will be before the court in the district court in Travis County?
Well, if the suit was brought in district court, actually, the suit was brought in Travis County by the council. At the time this suit was filed in El Paso, at the same time they filed suit in Travis County.
Okay.
So they recognize it. In Travis County, the court would first address the threshold issue as to whether the claimant had a workers' compensation policy that extended to the injury. In other words, was their employer as defined by the Act? Why is that critical?
And so there's going to be a jury trial on course and scope, right?
Only if there's a workers' compensation insurance policy. It's a threshold question. You don't get to the question of whether someone's in the course and scope if there's no coverage.
So how do you determine whether there's a policy? I'm just trying to figure out what this trial is going to look like.
Yeah, and I agree. The coverage question in a workers' compensation setting is different than a coverage question in any other policy. In any other claim, we have the four-corner rules where you look at the policy, you look at the date, and determine, does the policy create coverage? In a workers' compensation setting, coverage is a threshold into the entry into the system. The statute defines employer as someone who has employees and someone who has a workers' compensation insurance policy. If you don't have an employer, you do not have any access to the workers' compensation system. So the question, the coverage question that the court addresses is, does the entity meet the definition of employer under the labor code? And you look at the statutory definition because the workers' compensation policy has one thing of what they cover. We will cover all claims that arise under the workers' compensation act. That's it. That's what coverage, workers' compensation coverage provides. And the statute defines that. So the threshold inquiry here is not, is he an independent contractor or employee? That's a definition of employee. And the definition of employee, if you look at 401.0...
But let me make sure I understand. So the Travis County suit is going to be, you've got three purported employers.
Right.
And so you're going to look at, does employer A have a policy? Does employer B have a policy? Does employer C have a policy? And then that's the end of the Travis County action?
No, because Travis County also has authority to consider the rest of the, if they want to, if the plaintiff wants to see it, they can consider the rest of the issues if they were relevant and if the plaintiff sought that. Because 410.301 is not jurisdictional, as the court has held in Affley, and as the statute says, that's just a venue. It's only 410.255 that Travis County is jurisdictional. Now, in this case, the reason the issue is so important, the reason you have this threshold issue, which is rare and unique to this case, is because you had a non-subscriber. Admittedly, if you look at the plaintiff's petition, which is the sole source of the jurisdictional question, this court has held you look at the plaintiff's original petition, in this case the first amended petition, because they did amend. And that's page 26 of the record. And you focus on that, you'll see that the plaintiff pleads PGD, the entity, is a non-subscriber. It has no coverage.
So you think if it were a subscriber, then this case would be under 301?
There would be no question of who the employer is, because we know...
Well, there's a question about... And there's still a question about who the employer is.
No. The question is, for whom was he working in the course and scope of employment? Who is he an employee for, not who the employer is? They're different questions. Although logically they sound exactly the same, they're defined differently by the statute, and they serve different functions. The definition of employee, the definition of course and scope is someone who is injured in the course and scope of employment in furtherance of the affair of the employer. You assume that there's an employer. Who I'm working for in a workers' comp setting asks the question, assumes that I'm one of the people, is a subscriber. If they're not a subscriber, no aspect of the act applies. We go back to the 1867 remedy, the 1867 remedy of a common law cause of action against a non-subscriber.
That can be filed in El Paso.
It can be filed anywhere. It's just a pure venue question.
But if the guy was working in El Paso and his widow lives in El Paso, that's going to be filed in El Paso.
Perhaps. No, I don't think so. Under the common law question, we have the general venue statute, and it would be filed where the defendant place of business is, or the accident
occurred. Or where the accident
That's correct.
Occurred.
That's correct.
And the issue on who was his employer is who controls whether they encroach, who control the details of what he did?
More important, no. That's the question of whether he is in the course and scope of employment. Course and scope goes back to where you're in the furtherance of the affair. If the person, you can have a contract for hire and be an independent contractor if they don't control the details. But that's a question of course and scope, independent contractor.
So that one's tried where?
That's tried. It's tried where under the statute, in the venue of the claimant's residence, unless it's a death claim. However, all of those are pure venue questions. They have nothing to do with standard of review, and they don't apply. They don't require suit in Travis County under the non-compensability question.
So we weren't looking in this case at whether it's like who controlled the details.
No, I mean, that was an issue, but it wasn't an issue appealed.
Well, but how can you decide whether there was an employer? Because there was one if it was the bank or turnkey, but not if it was PGD, right?
That's correct. Justice Hector, correct.
Only way to resolve that issue is who was he working for?
No. The reason that's different in this case is because of the way they raised their pleadings. And again, we go back to the pleading and not the statutory definition. In this case, they allege that PGD was a non-subscriber. They say Liberty Mutual stipulated that he worked for PGD. Then they go on to say that the policies that the bank had or the policy that Liberty Mutual had should be extended to PGD. In other words, coverage should be extended to the non-subscriber for these reasons. I don't know how you get to a compensability question when you're talking about extending coverages under a policy under the Act.
But that's, I mean, we've had several cases in the dual employer context.
The single business enterprise. But this,
we look to who controls the employee, and if they're a subscriber, then you're in. If they're who controls the employee is not a subscriber, you're out.
That's not what, there are those cases, but that's different from the pleadings in this case.
Why?
Because that's not the allegations in this case. They don't allege control. They don't even raise the issue of the right to control. What they raise is a question of extending coverages to entities based on different entity theories. In other words, they're saying that, on one, they're saying that it's a sham corporation, they're really one and the same entity, and therefore you can't have a policy of coverage for one employer and not a policy for another. Now, there's a plethora of appellate decisions and appeals panel decisions refusing to apply, refusing to disregard corporate structures with regard to insurance policy. They don't do that because if a sham is perpetrated, it's not by the carrier and the carrier hasn't collected premiums. So they just generally don't extend it. But that's what they were doing in this case, and that's what their pleadings give rise to.
The Court of Appeals, though, thought the issue was who employed who.
Well,
it seems it says this clear form review of the commission's decision. The basis for the appeals panel's affirmance of the hearing officer's findings is agreed that the decedent was not an employee of any of the companies.
That's correct. I agree that that's in the decision, and I believe that if you read the decision alone, absent the record, it could be confusing.
So you know, the Court of Appeals misstated the issue.
I think that there was a misunderstanding of the purpose of 401.401011 section 18. Section 18 defines employer. And the issue identified, as you'll see in our brief where we identified the issue, is were these three entities employers for purposes of the act? That's different from a different question that was also addressed as to whether he was.
Well, then if that's a plea to the jurisdiction, don't we have to send it back down to let them? If all we're going to do, if we send it back down to see if they're going to plead that right of control is the issue, which they'll probably do now since you concede that that'll leave them in El Paso rather than Travis County, that's all we're here on?
No. No, we don't do that, because what you do is you define jurisdiction from the four corners of the pleadings.
But under Miranda and a lot of other cases, if you can replead to fit in under the jurisdiction, you got to have an opportunity to do that. And it seems like you should get an opportunity, since apparently the Eighth Court thought that's exactly what they were pleading.
I don't think that's what the Eighth Court thought. I think what they see is if the sentence Justice Heck read, if you read the rest of the decision, the next three sentences they outline their conclusions. One, there was an issue of coverage. Coverage is not compensability, and therefore it's under substantial evidence review. If that's their decision and they inarticulated the issue, that's not reversible. That's accurate. Unless this court reverses precedent in the past. And so you come to that conclusion only from reading that paragraph without reference to the record, which this court has.
You started out by saying that the difference between an independent contractor and an employee in this case is not material. It's not even an issue we'll need to reach.
That's correct.
And I'm still not sure if you've tied those loose ends, for me at least. Okay. You did say that for an employer to exist under the labor code, they must both have employees and workers' comp coverage.
Correct.
Since the person covered must be an employee by definition under 401.011.18, why doesn't the question of whether the person is really an independent contractor versus an employee come into play? Because if he's not an employee, then he doesn't fit under this definition, right?
They're different, and let me. If
independent contractor and employees are
no,
different.
No. The question of whether there's an employer versus whether the employee question.
If you look at me on that distinction,
I will. If you start with how the act comes into place, in other words, how you enter the system, You look at 406.002 of the Labor Code. 406.002 of the Labor Code says the Act applies, coverage exists under the Act, coverage generally elective, coverage exists under the Act for an employer who elects to obtain workers' compensation coverage. Then they define an employer. It defines an employer as someone who has employees, not a claimant or injured worker, but employees, and has coverage. Yes, yes, that's correct. So that's the threshold question. Do you have an employer under the Act that gives rise to the right to even participate in the system? Then you have the next question. If you look at the definition of course and scope of employment, they use the word employee. Employee is defined under 18. And if you look at Section 18, employee is defined as someone who is under the right of control and is not an independent contractor for that part.
Employee is defined where?
I'm sorry, 401.012.
Okay.
And 401.012 defines employee, and if you look at Part B, they talk about in construction as an independent contractor. This was a construction situation. It's a different definition. The first question is, do we have employers? Why do you want to know who the employer is? Because who the employer is identifies the dependent, the person who's liable for benefits. Who do you bring to the commission? PGD wasn't there. They weren't there because the commission has no jurisdiction over PGD. They're non-subscribed. They had no carrier, so no carrier was there representing PGD in the proceedings. They had no representative in the proceedings. They're not subject to the Act. That's the employer question. He could have, in this case, the claimant could have said, I'm an employee of State Bank. And if that was the issue that they brought up and no other issue, it would have been a question of compensability.
So it sounds like you're saying that under 012, an employee does... An independent contractor can be an employee.
An independent contractor is generally not an employee under 401.012 unless the employer contracts and agrees to provide comp or unless the employer controls the details, as I read 401.012.
But the plaintiff could take the position, we don't care whether the policy is extended to PGD or not. We think that the decedent was the employee of one of these other
certainly can. He certainly can. But
that's
not
a 301 question.
It would be if that occurred, but that's not what happened in this case. And because the court has to look at the pleadings and basis, he could have filed a pleading after we filed an amended pleading, after we filed our plea of the jurisdiction, removing the allegations of please extend coverage.
So you agree with the amici, both one that has argued and the other, that who you're working for is a 301 issue?
I think the question of whether you're in the course and scope of employment for a specific entity is a 301 question. That's correct. I agree with that. And we've never challenged that at any level.
Is a 255 issue because the question is, in your view, whether the existing policies extended to non-subscribe.
That's correct. And the pleadings make that a threshold question. Not us. The defendant didn't make that threshold question. If you look at 410.302, which governs jurisdiction for 410.301, it says that in this case, in a workers' compensation case, the court is limited to issues decided by the appeals panel and in which the pleadings complain of. And they say that the pleadings have to specifically identify the issues which the claimant claims is aggrieved by. In this case, the issues that they identified in page 26 and 27 are the issues of extending coverage. Because that's what they identified as the threshold issue, that's what the court looked at. Justice Brister is correct. There is an opportunity to amend. But if you look at the cases, the opportunity to amend doesn't occur after the court has entered its order. The court looks at the pleadings, makes a decision. If the party asks to amend and concur it before the courts make its decision, then we're there. In this case, And there's a recent case, Roski, I'm sorry, I don't have the cite for the court, where the party says, I should have had an opportunity to amend, and I didn't. And the court says, well, wait a second. The plea to the jurisdiction was filed, and you amended. It doesn't say you have an unlimited opportunity to amend, just the opportunity to amend that occurred here. Several questions that were raised by the panel. Why isn't this venue? Why isn't this venue? It's not venue because the court has said for the last 20 years that appeals from administrative agencies are appeals of limited jurisdiction. They're not general jurisdiction like general venue. And therefore, venue, the right court, and timing is not limitations, but jurisdictional for the court. Much like whether I file my notice of appeal within 30 days. If I file it 50 or 60 days later, the appellate court has no jurisdiction because the decision below becomes final and non-appealable. That's why it would be jurisdictional as opposed to just venue and not a limitations question. Coverage question, the court asked about the non-payment of premiums. Because this is a statutory vehicle, the insurance company must file a notice of coverage with the state agency, and until a supplemental form is filed reflecting to the state agency that no coverage exists and it's been on file for 20 days, there's coverage whether they pay premiums or not. Because the statute, coverage under the statute, coverage under the act, and coverage under the policy are united by the legislature.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Justice Hack, I do have one question.
Yes.
Counsel, Mr. Brenner.
Mr. Brenner. Judge Johnson has a question.
Pleading question.
Yes, sir.
If they had pled that Mr. Morales was an employee of one of these three alleged employers, would it change your position? Because as I understand your position, you say their pleading is, and I've not looked at it, but their pleading says he was an employee of PGD who was a non-subscriber.
It did.
So I'm trying to differentiate there. If they'd pled he's an employee of one of these three, would it change your position?
You mean any one of the three?
Yeah, if their lawsuit said he was an employee of one or all of these.
Justice Johnson, if they did not have PGD in there, if they didn't include a non-subscriber, then there would be no coverage question. But because State Bank was covered under the Act, they had a policy. And also, Turnkey was covered under the Act. There was no question of coverage with regard to those entities. But because they brought in the non-subscriber and linked that, then that was a threshold question that they chose to create. Okay. And that's why.
So then it would only be, your position would only be, it's a coverage question going to Travis County if there's an allegation against a non-subscriber.
Or correct in this case.
In this case.
Under the unique facts. I also agree that the Houston General case deals with a policy that's not in effect. And that was clearly a coverage question.
Thank you.
Regarding the allegations in this case, at page 26 of the record, plaintiff alleges Guadalupe Morales was an employee of PGD and of State National Bank. At page 27 in the record.
That's in your petition?
That's in our first amendment.
Your first amended petition.
Which was on file prior to the dismissal. On page 27 in the record, decedent was also an employee of Turnkey Services. So, and as this court has explained in Garza versus Excel Logistics, in Wingfoot Enterprises versus Alvarado, a single employee can have multiple employers. So the respondents have conceded here that if we were just talking about whether he's an employee of Turnkey or the bank, that we're under course and scope of employment and we're under 301. The fact that there's an additional question regarding PGD, even if this court were to say that coverage is somehow a threshold issue independent of compensability, doesn't change that fact. But the more important point is that coverage is an element of course and scope of employment, and that's because of the statutory definition. Course and scope of employment says, were you performing an activity, an employee performing an activity in the furtherance of an employer. Employer is specifically identified as defined as someone that has workers' comp coverage.
And PGD was not before the commission?
No, Your Honor.
Because they admitted they did not have any comp policy in effect. No question about that.
That's correct. However, at page 27, we allege of the First Amendment, in the First Amendment petition at page 27 in the record, we allege that between the contract under PGD and turnkey, it falls under the Staff Leasing Act. So it's a matter of the contract there.
And was that before the commission also, that allegation?
Commission found that the Staff Leasing Act didn't apply.
The commission, and if you look at, I believe, page 34 and 35 of the record, you'll see this, never reached that question. Because they said he's an employee and not an independent contractor, they said we're not going to reach these issues regarding whether they said staff leasing doesn't apply because he's not an employee at all. They never reached the question, if he's an employee, is he then an employee of both employers? Respondent's argument shows the fundamental unworkability of trying to distinguish coverage and compensability. Every compensability question can be recast as coverage. For example, the date an injury occurred is only coverage if it falls within the time frame of the policy, but it also affects compensability, as the Beaumont Court held in Parkerson. Also, he referred to pleas of the jurisdiction applying to pleading. That's in the immunity context. This court in Albertson held differently. Finally, with respect to Justice Wainwright's previous question about Garcia, the issue regarding...
I have one question, if you don't mind, just a second.
Yes.
Didn't know that light was going to expire so quick. This is still confusing to me. What is the relief you're seeking from the court here? What relief are you
from
seeking?
From this court?
Yes.
We're asking this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and let's go back and try this case in El Paso County under 301 under a modified de novo standard and not send us to Travis County under 255, where it's not only just being in Travis County, it's under the it'd be an administrative review under the APA. We're asking this court to hold we're under 301 when we go back to El Paso for 301 review.
And that would be a trial?
Pardon?
That would be a trial? And
it would be a modified de novo trial under the provisions of Chapter 410 in the Labor Code.
What were you going to say about Garcia?
In Garcia, this court identified as possible collateral issues, things such as attorney's fees, and sanctions, and medical benefits. This court later, in a functional restoration, explained that although that may have been the intent of 255 as drafted, it didn't actually get there. That medical benefits didn't fall under 301 or 255. 301, though, applies to any issue that affects income benefits or death benefits, and that's what's at issue in this case. It's death benefits arising out of the death of Guadalupe Morales.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first case, and